Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Angharad Carrick and Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, chaos at the tax office. This Is Money has spoken exclusively to an insider to find out what's going so wrong at HMRC that it's leaving business owners in the lurch. Also today, someone's got to do it, but being an executor can be a right ordeal. We give you some tips on how to manage. Plus, rates rise again, but was it the right call from the Bank of England, or is it time to ease off? Meanwhile, better news for mortgage rates, and in one of the oddest polls I think I've seen, apparently a quarter of us Brits want fake lawns banned. What's plastic grass done to us? Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, making tax digital was meant to make the tax system more efficient and painless for everyone. Alas, like all the best government plans, things went a little awry at HMRC. The push for digital has left some people waiting months to receive basic tax information. The seasonal closure of the self-assessment helpline until September has drawn particular ire from business owners who needed to send their quarterly tax return by the 31st of July, and it comes just a short while after the permanent closure of the HMRC VAT registration helpline. Now, one insider has been speaking to This Is Money and telling them what it's really like to work there. Ang, this is your story, is it not? First, what am I talking about in making tax digital for anyone unlike myself, who doesn't have to go through the painful process of anything related to getting in contact with the tax office?
So Making Tax Digital was an initiative that was launched in 2016, and it was essentially a way to kind of push HMRC into the 21st century. It requires businesses and individuals to keep digital records and report quarterly rather than yearly. So in theory, it's a really, really good idea, but in practice, it hasn't really worked. So the main aim, other than to help businesses, was to kind of save the government a bit of cash, improve customer service, but it has gone £1 billion over budget, and it seems as if customer service is even worse. I think the most frustrating thing for so many business owners that we've spoken to is that HMRC is so far from being digital. I mean, they don't use email, for example. With VAT registration, you have to receive everything by post rather than online, which they say is an anti-fraud measure, but I feel like we've had online banking for so many years, and so I'm not entirely sure why everything needs to be done manually at HMRC. The accountants that, you know, we've spoken to, have, they're at a loss as to why everything moves so slowly. And I think, you know, they say if HMRC was a business, it would probably be shut down at this point.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, maybe they're taking that £1 billion over budget and just scrawling it back from every department, like customer service, like their function and ability to do actually what they're meant to do. Are we being unfair? I mean, there are a lot of hard workers there. What is the cause? What are HMRC saying is the justification to all this?
Yeah, I mean, we know there's been issues with HMRC for a while. I mean, there've been grumbles from accountants for years and years and years, but I think the pandemic was a real trigger. They cut staff, you know, people weren't working from home. HMRC obviously say the pandemic has nothing to do with it and actually everything's fine, you know, but actually wait times on the main helplines have sort of doubled. They say the average is 12 minutes. I think it's probably more like an hour. You know, I spoke to an accountant this week who said that he'd spent 9 hours last week just waiting, just being put on hold. And then as soon as they get through, they're cut off. So I think in the last few months, I think the main issues have been they decided to close VAT registration helpline. So this was specifically for people who have queries when they first apply. You know, they're looking to start up. And HMRC instead have directed them to the normal VAT helpline, which kind of sounds okay in practice, but given wait times are already ridiculously high, according to business owners and accountants, it seems like a very odd decision. A few weeks after that, then without any real explanation, they closed the self-assessment helpline for the summer. So that closed on the 12th of June and it doesn't open until the 4th of September.
Lee, it reminds me of the conversation we had, was it last week, when we spoke about customer service, everybody being pushed on these chatbots. God, just to have a, especially with something like your tax, which can be quite complicated as well. And you get fined if you get it wrong.
Well, the last couple of weeks, Georgie, I think This Is Money's really shone the spotlight on incompetence across the board in all kinds of companies and government organisations when it comes to customer service. And as you were saying, we were talking about OVO last week and how difficult it was for people to resolve billing issues. This week, Ang's really shone the spotlight on what's happening at the tax office. Now, the story that she's written, I mean, it's had almost 2,000 comments in there. It's well worth having a look in those comments, because they paint a real picture of what's potentially happening in the tax office. I can't really say too much off of the comments because we haven't put it all to the HMRC. So it's hard for me to sort of pick out these comments that are in there and make accusations without putting it to HMRC first. But you get a real flavour in there of what's going on. And I mean, call wait times of over an hour seems to be a common cause for complaint, HMRC. And exactly right, Georgie. Tax, it can be complicated. Mm. Now, quite often we'll go years for business, not just for people, but for businesses as well, small businesses, self-employed people. It could be a real minefield of all kinds of different tax traps and things to get your head around. And I think when you get one of those sort of letters or whatever, quite often the autopilot thing that you want to do, more so than probably any other area of your financial life, is to speak to someone at the tax office, because you don't want to get in trouble. We want to make sure you're doing the right thing. But if you're having to wait an hour, people don't have an hour to wait. You know, that's the thing. Like, you know, we're used to things happening a bit faster than that these days. Now, I get it. I think that staff are under probably quite a bit of pressure. This is not an attack on HMRC staff whatsoever. They have to deal with, I would suspect, quite difficult queries. And that means, compared to a lot of other like businesses or organizations, probably I would expect that call lengths are probably a bit longer than elsewhere. So that puts a bit of pressure on the call wait times and all of that kind of thing. But it's simply put, it's just not acceptable. I mean, this country is built on small businesses. You know, they don't want to spend hours trying to get through to the tax office. They've got a business to run. It's already hard enough. We've just had a pandemic. We've got a cost of living crisis. Small businesses are struggling. You know, big businesses are struggling. We've seen the news of Wilko this week. You know, it's time is money. And if it's an issue that needs to be resolved over the phone, I think there is an expectation for things to be better. And this is what the insider has kind of alluded to in this story. And Ang's not letting it drop. And I'm sure she'll give you an update in a sec. But we've had lots of people get in touch, and we'll carry on looking into this and taking people's stories where we're just like, wow, I can't believe that's happening.
A high level view, it seems that, yeah, I'm 1 hour, I've spent hours on the phone to HMRC. The government is desperate. We've been desperate for decades to increase productivity in this country. And you have a situation where the tax office, you can spend your entire day wasted just trying to get through to someone to sort out an issue. And if you are on the phone to the tax office, you are doing the right thing. As Lee said, you're wanting to do the right thing. You're wanting to pay the right amount of tax. You're wanting to do it correctly. You know, it's all sorts of areas of life, childcare, waiting lists. And if we sort all of this stuff out, couldn't we just get a much more productive economy? But anyway, Ang, I'm not going to ask you a question about how to get productivity up in the economy. But it is. I mean, it's materially, it does impact people. It's not just like, oh, yeah, you can hang on the phone. I mean, I made some brownies. You know, you can do productive stuff. Don't know how useful brownies are when you're on the phone to HMRC. But look, they were very nice at the end of it. And then HMRC said, sorry, you've got to call back tomorrow. You have no idea, 6 hours or something it took me, I think. But yeah, look, materially, this is impacting people. You've been speaking to people on the inside, and look, and as Lee said, to reiterate, this is not an attack on those people that work very hard at all levels of customer service, you know, and not just in HMRC, in all of those businesses. But it does seem to me that across the board, I don't know if it's the pandemic, but what is it? Customer service has just gone absolutely downhill everywhere, it seems to me. Or is that just me being miserable and old and moany?
No, I think you're right. You know, especially in this context, it's, you know, it's the chief kind of complaint when people get in touch about HMRC. People are happy to pay their tax. You know, they know that it's the right thing to do, but when they're trying to, they can't, because, you know, they're trying to ask questions of, you know, the experts, and they can't get through. And when they do, you know, they're cut off. I think, you know, to reiterate what both of you said, it is absolutely not an attack on HMRC staff, especially kind of customer services, because, you know, the person that got in touch and I spoke to, you know, they got in touch with me because they found out about the closure of the self-assessment helpline from my article. And I think that really speaks to the conditions that these people are, you know, are put through, because, you know, frankly, they're on very low salaries, they're given very little training, they often have to work extra hours, they're drastically understaffed, this insider said. And this poor person said that they actually dread going to work. It's a really, really sorry state of affairs. And I think that is, you know, something since the article was published this week, a lot of people have said is that the people on the other side of the phone, they're not accountants. You know, they are given probably 5 days training and then they're thrown into, you know, a mess of a tax system that, you know, I don't understand fully. I don't think accountants understand fully. So to expect them to give people proper answers over the phone, it's kind of unfair. So I do have a lot of sympathy. When we put these claims to HMRC, they unsurprisingly said very little about it. They said that it wasn't the pandemic and that, it, you know, working from home had absolutely, there was absolutely no reason for that to be, why wait times had increased. So I don't really know what the problem is, to be honest. I don't imagine closing helplines is going to help, though.
What is the solution here, apart from throwing tons of money at it? Is that the solution? Because I want to leave people with some sort of a what you can do in that situation, apart from making brownies. Other baked goods are available to make. Do we have anything positive to leave us with?
Yeah, I think, you know, keeping up the pressure, you know, we've had such a reaction to the article. I was quite surprised at how many people got in touch, and not just business owners, but accountants. And I think, you know, these people, the accountants know this system. They have spoken to HMRC about these issues, and it doesn't seem like HMRC are really willing to listen. I know these things are really expensive. But it is, you know, if we want to increase productivity, encourage people to start their own businesses. You know, an accountant got in touch yesterday and said that he was retiring early because he just couldn't deal with HMRC anymore. You know, that is not, it's not a great look for our tax office, is it?
No, not at all. Right. Well, from one headache to another, I'm glad you've done this, Tanya, talking about being an executor, because I've had to listen to my dad for years. And I actually updated my will recently, and he said, for the love of God, please don't make me your executor, because it is, while it is a great responsibility, it can also be an absolute nightmare. And my poor dad is years down the line of his like fourth time of doing it. Oh, it's horrendous. But you've got Stephen Gold, who's a retired judge and author, recently acted as executor for his beloved late aunt. Now, the process eventually saw him force a string of banks, finance firms and institutions to pay compensation for unacceptable errors and delays. Was HMRC in that? I don't think so. His torrid experience led him to produce a three-part series on This Is Money, and hopefully it's going to help us. And Tanya, you are also going to help us, because this is your area of expertise. But first, what am I talking about when I talk about an executor? What role do they do? How are they chosen? Can you say no?
Basically, an executor is someone who sorts out a will. They're appointed in a will by the person making it. And it's a question of getting all the information in about what the deceased person's assets are, applying for probate, which is just a matter of getting control over those assets so that you can sort them out. And then the final phase is actually distributing all the money to the beneficiaries. And you have to pay inheritance tax if any is due. And even if it's not due, you may well have to fill in the forms to prove it's not due. So it is actually quite a serious job. And you do have duties to the beneficiaries to do it properly.
What do you mean doing it properly?
Well, you're responsible for making sure that their interests aren't damaged financially. I won't get ahead of myself, but for instance, Stephen Gold really pushed Lloyds to put his aunt's money in an interest-bearing account rather than a zero-interest account. Now, that's an example of how he was acting in the best interests of the beneficiaries. Mm. And you have to do things in a timely manner. You have to be fair. You have to be independent. Even if you are a beneficiary yourself, you have to, treat everybody fairly. And as you can gather from all this, it's a really important job. And when you appoint somebody, when you're writing your will, you should really give it a lot of thought. And we have run stories in the past where lawyers have given advice about how to choose an executor. And especially in the situation where you might have warring factions in your family, if it's a close family and everything is quite straightforward, then it's quite possible for just the whoever the beneficiaries are to be the executors. You can have more than one. And one of the important things you need to do is, as well as deciding who they are and who's the best person to handle this, you have to also decide whether you're going to allow your executors to act jointly or severally. And that basically means, do they have to agree every single decision, or can they make decisions on their own? Now, if you've got two people who get on and trust each other, then you can imagine that one of them needs to go off and sort out the bank accounts, and they can do that on their own. And another takes the sort of second half of the list and does that on their own. You can see how that could be split up quite easily. But if they have to act jointly in everything, it's a lot more time consuming. But on the other hand, if there's a lack of trust there, then you can understand. I mean, it depends on your personal circumstances and who you're appointing, really. You can appoint a professional, but obviously that's going to cost you. It'll cost the estate money, and it's expensive. And if it gets dragged out by everybody calling up and saying, what's the state of play? And then every time the lawyer writes a letter saying, it's as it was last month, madam, then ka-ching. Yeah. So you can't really say for definite. You can do it yourself, but it is time consuming and it is a serious matter. Now, your question as well about how can you get out of it? You can renounce, but you have to do it before you do any of the work. You have to do it right at the beginning, straight away. If you start on it, there's a legal term called intermeddling, and that means you've intermeddled. Then you really can't get out of it. Once you've started, you have to continue. I mean, obviously,
what happens if you're like, no, I just can't do this anymore? Not because if you get ill health or something, I imagine they're probably quite good with that. But what if you just go, I can't do this anymore, I'm out? What, you go to jail?
I don't think you go to jail, but the beneficiaries would have to take action to remove you, I suppose, which is quite a complicated area. I would definitely, if you're trying to remove an executor for any reason, I would definitely see a lawyer and get legal advice about that. Obviously, people might die while they're being an executor. In that scenario, an administrator would be appointed. Probably one of the beneficiaries would volunteer to do it, or a lawyer at that point would be brought in to take it over. And when people die without a will, then in those scenarios, an administrator is also appointed. So that is quite a common issue. So it would move on to that. But basically, yes, if you are asked to be an executor and you don't renounce it immediately, you are definitely stuck with the job.
What I'll say is, when you write your will, go to the person that you want to be your executor, and it's a compliment. You're obviously picking someone trustworthy, someone who's good with money and all that, and ask them, because I refused. My mum asked me if I'd be hers. No. I put it down to I'd be too emotional at the time, but I also just couldn't be bothered. No. You know, there's better qualified and more enthusiastic people to do that. But Stephen Gold had a not very good experience, a terrible experience, but he's written about it to help us. So what was his experience? And what little tidbits can we take from it if you are an executor? And well done to you if you are or will be one.
Stephen Gold is a retired judge. So as you can imagine, he is he's a competent person, a clever person, and he's got all advantages on his side in terms of being able to handle this kind of thing. And he decided that it could be done without a lawyer being involved, that he would take it on himself. And just harking back just briefly to what you were saying about HMRC, there are a lot of accountants who are coming forward to Anne with HMRC who are absolutely in despair. And there's a parallel here. Stephen Gold is, you know, a professional person who can handle himself in this scenario. But he also, you know, had extraordinary trouble going through what should be. It's a difficult job to some extent, and you have a lot of responsibility. But as he points out, a lot of it is clerical. It's a lot of systematically ringing up all these banks and institutions. Apparently his aunt had had a huge string of banks and building societies that she was with. And you have to get the information out of them. You have to do the probate. You have to do the inheritance tax form. And then you have to ring round everybody again and prize the money out of them. So Stephen starts off by saying that I think he was genuinely shocked at how incompetent the people he dealt with were. It comes through from the way he's written it. It's a very entertaining account. Obviously, at the heart of this is his beloved aunt has died. So there's a serious side to this, but he really approached this with real spirit. You have to read it for the full import of it to be conveyed, but he certainly does not mince his words about the way he was treated. In the first part, he takes on BT. BT repeatedly wrote to his aunt, his deceased aunt, again and again and again, and he complained repeatedly about this, and in the end decided to go for compensation. He was offered £25 to start with, and he rejected it, and they went up to 50. He rejected it again. At 75, he said, okay, I'll accept 75. They then sent a check addressed to his aunt and addressed the sort of the resolution of the complaint to his aunt, which was the very thing that he'd been complaining about in the first place. And so therefore he complains again. Yeah, another 50 quid compensation.
Oh my word.
So altogether, I mean, he made loads and loads of complaints and got lots of compensation out of a whole string of banks, and he managed to squeeze a goodwill payment out of the probate service as well, 50 quid, which he regarded on the low side but decided to accept. The probate, obviously going around all the banks continually and keeping records of how long they've kept you waiting and sending out endless complaint letters is a massive pain, which he writes about. And he gives a really good template letter that people can adapt for their own use. He's obviously been very successful squeezing compensation out of people, so it's well worth a look at his template. But at the very heart of the process is applying for probate. We have written a lot of stories about delays at the probate service, and it's really heartbreaking because these are grieving families. We've had a lot of lawyers get in touch with us. This again is a theme. It's the lawyers who are very exercised on their clients' behalf. I mean, they've got plenty of things to do other than talking to This Is Money and being in news stories. They don't have to, but I think a lot of them, like the accountants that Ang talked to, are upset at the way their clients are being treated and how slow it has been. The problems at the probate service seem to be that they made really steep staff cuts, including a very senior people. They have, as they repeatedly told us, taken on 100 new staff at the start of the year, and they are apparently making inroads into the backlog. But the trouble is, they haven't actually said, I have asked, but they haven't actually said who these 100 people are. But if they are new starters who need to be trained up, that does not replace somebody really senior with loads of knowledge who retired at the end of a long career from the top management position in the probate service. That does not, 100 people does not even replace one of those people, frankly. So you can see the problems that arise. And I also think that if you have quite a straightforward probate application and you manage to do it online, you've got a much better chance of getting it through. But even if you do everything properly, they can put a stop on it for lots and lots of reasons, and it can be really minor things like a staple being removed from a will, and all of a sudden endless delays and you're accused of tampering with the will. All sorts of things like that can arise. And you just don't know whether you're going to be caught out. And people, you know, literally wait weeks and weeks. Stephen waited 16 weeks. He recounts an amusing call he had with a very stern person who wouldn't tell him anything about his probate application whatsoever. However, stunningly, the next day, he got the probate through. There was no indication during this call that it was all about to be resolved. It's well worth reading all three parts that are now published of Stephen's account. If you think you're ever going to be an executor, you've been appointed as one in a will, it does give an indication of what you're in for and tells you whether you might want to renounce pretty swiftly if necessary. But it's fairly good template to follow, and at least he's got the satisfaction of knowing that he added a lot of compensation to his aunt's estate to be distributed among the beneficiaries.
And I'm sure there's lots of information and advice, as you said, in there that can help other people. Lee, you're nodding along there. The problem with all of this, isn't it, is it's, yes, you know, as Ang's been dealing with, it's very frustrating for business owners and accountants to have to go through HMRC. But what Tanya's been investigating here is something that hits people at a really horrible time. People have just died.
It really is. And actually, you know, Stephen sort of pitched this story series to us in a kind of, he was so frustrated and just bemused, I think, by the whole, you know, everything that you've got to do and how difficult companies make it. At a time when you're grieving, when you're vulnerable, when you don't really want to be having to have to do all of this. And actually, some of the reactions, some of the emails that we've had through from readers, I mean, someone said, thank God for Stephen Gold in an email yesterday, saying that this series, they were going through a really difficult probate, delays at the probate office, all sorts of myriad of difficulties closing accounts, all that kind of stuff. And the way that Stephen's written this is in a kind of lighthearted way, in about a very serious topic. And I think it's really resonated with people, and it's done really well this week, because it is a frustration. And actually, I remember a fair few years ago now, there was a campaign from our colleagues on MoneyMail about basically, especially banks, being better when it comes to bereavement and having better bereavement teams and sorting things out much quicker. So I think that actually banks have probably become a little bit better with it on the whole. And I think actually, when you look at the times and things that Stephen spent with banks, it's not as bad as other organizations like BT, like NS&I, for example. It felt like, when I was reading it, I could feel the stress coming through the words. But I mean, he ended up with £600 compensation for the estate from all of the delays from the different companies. But I think it's absolutely unforgivable when someone passes away and correspondence is still directed to them. You know, it hits people in different ways, depending on if it's a relation or a friend or how close you were. But you're dealing with grief. People deal with grief in different ways. But it can be like a dagger in the heart to see a letter come through addressed to, you know, someone that has passed away. I can't imagine. And it's an upsetting state of play. But the positive on this, Georgie, is Stephen's there. The template letter is really, really good. The three-part series is really, really worth reading. And if we can somehow get companies to get better at this bereavement side of things, and we keep putting the pressure on, because we will, there'll be more stories in the coming weeks and months about probate. You know, it's a subject that I think really does need to be covered in this way. We'll keep putting the pressure on.
Well done. That's it. Part one.
I'm now joined by Sam North from eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the market. So Sam, what's been going on?
Well, currently we're looking like equities across the board are going to finish a little bit lower, but not in a way that would worry me too much. The US jobs report was mixed, and so far markets don't mind that too much. Elsewhere, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the 14th time since 2021. It's battling the worst case of sticky inflation of any major economy that there is. They continue to highlight the upside risks to inflation, and markets probably see about two more hikes to come. Earnings wise, the big ones were Amazon and Apple. Amazon fired on all cylinders, Apple less so. Revenues slowed there. The truth is we've had a really good start to the year, a pullback from the highs in August and September potentially, which would be the seasonally is the worst month, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. And if anything, it would give bullish investors exactly what they want, an opportunity to buy lower down.
And what's on your radar for next week?
Yeah, well, as with always, the Monday and Tuesday after a US jobs report are pretty quiet. It acts as a bit of a reset for financial markets. And this time, no different. The first 2 days might drag, if anything. And then on Wednesday, you've got Chinese inflation. Thursday, you've got US inflation. And then Friday, UK GDP. And that really wraps up the economic data. Earnings-wise, most of the big names are already completed, but you do have some next week worth keeping an eye on. Eli Lilly, Glencore, Disney, Honda, Alibaba and Siemens, which I'm sure many people would recognise. I wouldn't be surprised if we've got a couple of quiet weeks coming, but of course, that's famous last words.
They really are famous last words. That was Sam North from eToro.
Thanks, Lee.
Welcome back. We got the 14th rate rise on the bounce from the Bank of England this week. It's up to 5.25% from 5%. And expectations are there is probably another rise or two to come down the line before the MPC stop turning the screw on borrowers. But has any of this actually helped with inflation? You know, it's falling, but can the Bank of England take the credit? And what will it mean for savings and mortgage rates? Lee Boyce, you know, there was a time when, well, we were like, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? Nothing, nothing, nothing. And now it's like, we're bored because it keeps going up, aren't we? Well, borrowers probably aren't.
I was actually, before we came on this podcast, thinking, are people getting a bit numb to this now? You know, it's like, it almost feels like earlier in the week, I was reading about it was going to go up by 0.25 percentage points. It's almost like we kind of knew that's what was going to happen. It was almost like a shoo-in. And I think that's like where it's kind of going. It's just become sort of nailed on. Like, I think, you know, there's so much information at our fingertips now. It's kind of like we kind of see the direction of travel. Now, it looks like, you know, the forecast out of the markets are pricing in two more rate hikes to about 5.75 or 6%, somewhere between those two measures. And that's where it looks like the rate rise train might finally end. And then it's likely that base rate is going to stick around 4%. Ish over the next couple of years. That seems to be what the forecasters are saying now. We had that inflation data a couple of weeks back that seems to put everyone in a bit of a better mood. But it was quite interesting this week because MPC, the nine members, are actually more split than usual over this. So six members voted for this 0.25 percentage point rise, but two voted for a 0.5 percentage point rise and one voted to do nothing, which is quite unusual for there to be a split like that. So obviously there's a kind of, is everyone thinking in the same direction now on the committee? And I think that, you know, we'll get some more inflation data. We'll see what the next, you know, if anything's fallen further potentially, but there's more pressures on the horizon. For example, oil prices are back up. So petrol prices are back up, nudging up again. They won't want to be seeing that when they're trying to get inflation under control. But yeah, it's now looking likely that we've got a couple more on the horizon. I think a lot of it is priced in now for savers and mortgages. So we did see some lenders earlier in the week actually cut their rates. That was before the decision. And so NatWest, Halifax, Virgin Money, you know, big lenders. We're making 0.3 percentage point up to 0.3 percentage point cuts ahead of this decision. So it was almost like they felt like it was kind of nailed on. There's probably going to be a few more lenders in the same way. Savings rates, we've discussed on the podcast numerous times, that they've already been rising. And, you know, the wondering is now, are fixed rates peaked at 6%? Since they seem to be stuck there now at the moment, that's where they've kind of hit. We keep saying there's probably a little bit more room to grow in easy access, and that is what's kind of happened this week. So there was a Best Buy that launched from Shawbrook at 4.63% easy access, which is pretty good. Then we had a number of banks yesterday that sort of contacted us and said, we're raising our rates with the base rate decision. And you think, oh, marvellous. So HSBC and First Direct, First Direct's part of HSBC, they're passing on the 0.25 percentage point rise straight away onto their Easy Access savers. Savings rates. The trouble is First Direct is now paying 2% and HSBC is paying 2.25%. That is a good solid 2 and a bit percentage points below the Shawbrook deal. They're the best of the big bunch, really. Like the other banks, you know, still below 2%. Nationwide bumped up theirs by 0.38. Bumped up their rates to 4.25%. It's still way below the Shawbrook deal.
Oh yeah,
it's still way down our savings table. So I think it's just one of those things now where I think like the FCA, we had this report earlier in the week about our savers and the 14-point action plan. We're going to make banks pay a fair
consumer
rate.
Consumer duty from the FCA.
Yeah,
need to treat us fairly, and so they've gone to the banks and demanded they give an explanation as to why they're not passing on the rates, because it's about a quarter of the rates, whereas they bump up mortgage rates.
And we crunched the figures this week, and the net interest
margin help,
of the banks. Well, the net interest margin of the banks are just growing. So, you know, they've made another almost £20 billion in the first 6 months. You know, they're not doing too badly. But as I keep saying, I mean, if that annoys you, I think you've just got to move the money out. You've got to move money out. And the banks aren't having to offer competitive deals. It's a different thing. You have big banks, and then you have challenger banks. The challenger banks need to be at the top of the Best Buy tables to get people's money in, because people aren't familiar with the brands. They like to have, a lot of people like to keep their money under the same roof, so they stick with their bank. All of that stuff that we've talked about before, lots of people just like to keep money in their bank, and the bank isn't having to offer Best Buy rates in order for people to stick around. If everyone moved their money out, they'd have to start offering better rates because they need to attract the money back in. But it's just not how it works. And lots of people have current accounts. I know lots of people who have current accounts, they keep loads of money in there. I think they just like it. They like the feeling of having 4 or 5 figure sums in their current account, earning no interest. They just like it. And I think that is a really common thing. It's all well and good trying to make the banks play fair with savings, but also people got to help themselves as well. You know, not to be a doom monger, but it's kind of like, move your money if you're not happy with the banks making a lot out of you.
Agreed, Lee. And I just want to ask, away from the actual figure of the interest rate, the governor, Andrew Bailey, was talking about the outlook and what he expects coming down the line. I mean, the inflation he expects at 5% was it? But the economy isn't quite so good.
Yeah, I think the economy is not in great shape, which is not surprising. Inflation wise, I think it's really easy on kind of base rate day to look specifically on what's changed. But actually, the key thing is kind of looking to where inflation is going to be by the end of the year. I mean, it looks like Rishi Sunak's plan to halve inflation may well work. I think it will be around the 5% mark by the end of the year. And then it will hopefully reach the 2% target in the second quarter of 2025. So that's 2 years from now. And that's 3 months later than the bank said in May. But the most recent inflation reading was pretty positive. You know, it's at 7.9%. The problem is that the core inflation, which is essentially everything but kind of things that move, so food, energy, food, alcohol, you know, tobacco, that sort of thing, is really what they call sticky. So it means that it's kind of stuck at the same level and is not moving, which was kind of fine. But, you know, we spoke months and months ago about energy being the biggest driver of inflation. But energy prices have now fallen and, you know, inflation is still at a high. And it's really difficult. I really don't envy the Bank of England, because it's a really difficult situation to be in. I think, you know, it's not like the 1970s. They can't pull the same levers in the same way and expect the same outcome, partly because consumer spending is still pretty high. You know, when inflation reaches the levels we're seeing at the moment, the bank basically thinks consumers have too much money to spend. So they obviously ramp up the price of borrowing. But people have got more in their savings because they were locked in their houses for 2 years. And I think government help like the energy price guarantee scheme have also helped to kind of offset the impact of inflation on consumers. And within that, you know, the shift in the sort of housing market. So, you know, fewer people have a mortgage. And of those, you know, more people are on kind of fixed mortgages rather than variable mortgages. So it means that when the base rate rises, the impact, it just takes a little bit longer, which Andrew Bailey has kind of signaled. So it might take some more time to sort of see the impact of higher interest rates.
Do we thank the Bank of England for this, for inflation coming down?
Well, too soon to tell. It's heading in the right direction at the moment. And there were quite a lot of voices calling this time for a pause, for a bit of breathing space. They decided not to do that, although it's interesting that they were a little bit split on what to do next at the meeting. The trouble is, I don't have enough information to know. The nine people on the Monetary Policy Committee are all really serious economists, and they are independent. They're not politicians. And so they will have gone through all the data and come up with their, you know, their best recommendation, and then they'll have voted on it. What I will say is, if inflation suddenly started heading north again and they paused, then everybody would be accusing them of getting it wrong again. I mean, we've heard Simon on this podcast many times sort of saying that he thought they were too slow to start raising interest rates. So you've got to have some sympathy with them. We can't really mark their card for, you know, another year and a half. But if they've looked at all the data and they think that to prevent inflation going up again, they've got to keep going with the rate rises, we've got to have some kind of trust in them to do that, and we'll find out. The things that they've been saying about the economy, well, they've said that they think inflation is going to be below 5% at the end of the year, and they think we're going to avoid recession, but it, on the other hand, it is gloomy. They're saying that, you know, there's going to be more unemployment, and that growth is really going to carry on being lackluster. So things are not good. But if we do manage to avoid a recession and they do eventually manage to get inflation down next year, then we might not be jumping for joy about how they've handled it. But at least the end result eventually will be what we all want. It's an incredibly tough situation to be in, and let's hope that they are analysing the figures rightly, and let's hope that inflation doesn't start going up again, because that would be really terrible.
It would indeed. Before we move on to plastic lawns, can't wait, Tanya, I do want to ask you, because MPs making waves with comments, you know, Mel Stride, an MP, talking about how over 50s should get back on their bikes and work at Deliveroo. But, you know, whether you agree with that sort of thing or not, it's all related to the fact that the IFS said that, you know, people who'd costed their retirement perhaps during the pandemic due to inflation find themselves a little bit short now. And it's highlighted, I think, just how difficult it must be to calculate how much you're going to need to retire. You are the pensions expert. What did you make of all that?
Well, I don't know. Would Mel Stride like to get on a bike and ride around cities? These people were heroes in the pandemic, and they do a really, really tough job against really tough deadlines. And they're pretty low paid, and they're part of the gig economy. Steve Webb has written quite an interesting article for a rival publication, so I won't name it. And saying the thing is there's nothing wrong with taking these jobs if you're fit enough to do it. But there needs to be some jobs out there that are better paid and more suitable, perhaps, for people who are north of 50 and certainly north of 60. Not everybody can get on a bike at that age. And so, you know, that's actually putting some focus on retraining people into suitable jobs for their physical abilities would be helpful.
Absolutely right. I also think it goes back to that productivity issue. If you want people to be productive, wouldn't it be great having people who have great experience in their 50s coming back into something that they can use that experience for? I mean, if it's a delivery rider, then great, and they can do it and stay fit. Perfect. But probably better for businesses to find a way, I imagine, to get people back into the workplace, to give them jobs and train the young. Anyway, Lee, you finally provided me with a worthy and finally story. Plastic lawns.
Yeah, Georgie, I think the last few weeks I've realised that I haven't been ending the podcast on a kind of nice, fun, like, this is summer. We should be coming up with a nice ending. You know, we've gone through hardcore tax office meltdowns, probate, you know, we've knocked it out with base rate rises. Let's end it with some fun. So this is one of those real talking points, one of those stories in which I think
people
it is massively.
I've never mentioned fake lawns in my life, I'll be honest with you. Yeah. And you...
You're hanging out in the wrong pubs, Georgie. You know, but this is pub chat. This is like, oh, so and so up the road has only gone and got a plastic lawn. Oh, I can't believe it. It's that kind of, you know, you're not out in the suburbs. Maybe that's what it is. Like, you know, it needs to be more kind of, this is the sort of thing that's happening. People are getting more and more plastic lawn, and it's upsetting people.
We don't have plastic lawns in Surrey, Lee. We don't have plastic lawns in Surrey. Yeah, nor in North Yorkshire where I was before.
You say that.
Not where I am. It's just real flats.
Yeah. No, it is a massive talking point. It's very Marmite. You have a lot of people that think it's the best thing ever. A lot of people think it's absolutely dreadful. So we had a survey that we wrote at the weekend. Again, this had 2,000 comments on it. It kind of seems to have got hijacked the comment section.
Same as the HMRC.
Yeah. Oh my word! It absolutely blew up. And I think that in the comments, you've got a lot of people saying, "Absolutely hate it. Can't believe people get it." Then lots of people saying, "Actually, it's quite practical and it's good." And then it seems to have been hijacked by a lot of sort of plastic lawn salesmen, which I thought was quite funny. So the case in point of this and the whole knob of the story is that a quarter of Britons would be happy to support a full ban on the sale of fake plastic lawns. Now, I'm never really keen on anything being banned. You know, the choice is paramount for people. I'll be honest though, I am not a big fan of the plastic lawn. We have to talk through the pros and cons. So look, really quickly, so the pros of a lawn is quite hard wearing. It doesn't need to be watered, which in a time at the moment that feels fine, doesn't it? It doesn't need to be cut, so you don't need to plug in your electric lawnmower or all that kind of stuff. I mean, we've had a fair amount of rain, so I think everything's all right if you've got a normal lawn. But it's one of those things where, I don't know about other people that are listening to this podcast, but one of the greatest joys in my life is it's sort of April time, step out with my toddler and she'll say, "I think it's time, Daddy. It's time for that lawn to be mowed." And tidying up the garden, seeing all the wildlife out there, you know, we've got lots of birds out in the garden, bugs and all that kind of stuff. You stick in a plastic lawn and it kind of really does upset the ecosystem of your garden. I don't understand. Personally speaking, I don't understand. I can understand it in some circumstances if it's a really small garden, or you know, there's other practicalities. I'm sure lots of people will tell us why they have their plastic lawn after listening to this. But for like big spaces, I don't get it. You know, it's made of plastic. Is that good? I mean, I've known some people that have got it. I've got one friend who's got some at the back of the garden. So half of the garden is grass. Then the back of the garden is the fake stuff. You can't walk on it barefoot because it's too hot in the summer, which I find quite bizarre.
Does it melt ever?
I don't think it melts. I think it just gets so hot. And then you can get like foxes and things do their
business. What happens with the rain? Does it all just pool in it, or
I don't really think it does. I think there's been vast improvements in the last decade. Right. I think like in the actual like makeup of it and installation, like I think that they will tell you whether it's suitable or not. But it costs a lot of money. It's thousands and thousands of pounds. But I guess over the long run, you could argue, well, you don't need garden tools. You don't need the power to blah, 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 blah. But for me, it's a big no-no. And I honestly, if I was house hunting and I saw a plastic lawn, it would be a massive, like, don't like it. I'd rip it all up and start again. But again, it's a personal taste thing. I'm not into it. Maybe Ang or maybe Tanya's into it. I don't know. We'll find out.
Well, we will find out because I feel a bit disappointed. I was not part of this poll. I never got asked if I would want to ban plastic grass. I mean, I would just use concrete, no? Or like paving stones or slabs or something.
I mean, if you're a massive gardener, I get it and it looks really nice. I think in the article it says one of the pros is that it looks good all year round. But I'm not a massive gardener, but friends of mine that are, I think the whole point of gardening is that, you know, you deal with what your garden looks like as the seasons change, right? But, you know, in winter it looks a certain way, in summer it looks a certain way. So to have it look the same the whole year round, I kind of think defeats the point of of kind of getting into gardening. One thing that I have seen, because I'm looking for a rental property at the moment, is a trend of plastic grass rugs in living rooms. So maybe we need to do it. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but it looks bizarre and really uncomfortable. So maybe we can do a poll on that next week.
That sounds amazing. You've got to flag some of these to us. This sounds like a potential story. I mean, what's this trend all about? So you feel like you're in outdoors all year round. You've got it under your feet while you're watching Netflix. Is that
essentially. Yeah. Maybe it's a pet thing. I'm not entirely sure.
Oh God, I don't even want to go anywhere further in that conversation. Tanya, this is blowing my mind, this conversation. I literally don't know anyone. I think I've walked on plastic lawns or something, maybe, but I don't think I know anybody who's got one. Where do you sit on the plastic lawn fence?
I don't know anyone who's done it either, or who is likely to. I'm not in favour of bans either, each to their own. That's a good mantra for life, in my opinion.
Each to their own,
but I would not do it. I do not like it, and I would take issue with the fact that it looks nice all year round. I don't think it looks nice. It's just my personal opinion, though. Let me repeat, each to their own.
It's all right. I don't think anyone's going to hammer us on Twitter. You say that, you never know. Lee,
we've been diplomatic, I think, with our answers. I mean, you know,
let rip.
Yeah, this is a divisive thing. I don't like it. Tanya doesn't like it. Ang doesn't like it. Someone out there likes it. Obviously, people like it because there's a big business. But actually, saying that in this story, I'll end it on this, is that demand for fake lawn installation was actually down 48% in 2022 versus 2021. So maybe people have been put off a little bit. Maybe they've been burnt.
Who did this poll?
Who was the poll by? It was by a tradespeople website called mybuilder.com.
Okay, right.
It was of a fair few thousand people. An installation.
Don't doubt it's a legit poll.
It's a legit poll. Yeah, we would never
was
really
buy a grass installation service or something. I just like.
Yeah, no, it's marvelous. We don't really tend to write about anything poll wise that's under 2,000 people.
But it's
a comprehensive poll. The cost of installation is usually between £1,200 and £2,500. It's quite a lot of money in my mind. But then again, I say that. I remember trying to get a landscape gardener to sort of like tidy up our garden and stuff, and the quotes were mad. And I just thought, do you know what? I'm just going to leave it sort of semi-wild. And I'm glad I did, to be honest. Sometimes you can manicure this stuff too much. I don't have the time for the upkeep. Yeah. I like to mow the grass. I like to get rid of the weeds here and there, plant some nice things here and there as well. Use it for a few months. I mean, I don't feel like I've been out in the garden for about 6 weeks because it's just not been nice enough. So, mate, who cares? Do you know what? Who cares? We don't use our gardens enough for this country anyway. So,
exactly. It's better for the bees as well to leave it a bit well. Anyway, we went on longer than I imagined we would on this subject, but there you go. Fake grass. What do you think? You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any views about fake grass in or outside of the home, or really anything more important that you'd like the team to look into, Lee?
Yeah, if you're having some gripes with the tax man or probate office or anything like that, do get in touch at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet /X us at thisismoney. And you can also comment in the podcast article where this will live.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.